Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. Jeffrey A. Tucker is founder and president of the Brownstone Institute and the author of many thousands of articles in the scholarly and popular press and 10 books in 5 languages, most recently Liberty or Lockdown. He speaks widely on topics of economics, technology, social philosophy, and culture, and we're going to get into the amazing current spectacle of America's accelerating collapse. Here's our confab. It's a pleasure to get Jeffrey Tucker back on the podcast of the Brownstone Institute, an increasingly important venue for thoughtful discussion of what's going on in this country. Jeffrey, you wrote a while ago, you wrote an essay about the crisis of the expert class, and I call them the managerial class. It appears that they've absolutely squandered their authority in an orgy of bad faith. Can you tell us something about the expert class and their tribulations?
Yeah, I think the word managerial class dates from the 1940s, and it was a good insight to see that there's ever more people that are in charge and of people actually doing work, people with actual tactile experience and knowledge on the ground with actual things and people. Mm-hmm. The managerial class is sort of detached from that and yet has decisive control over the systems, and you know that began, I guess, in World War II, but it got worse as the decades have gone on. But the apotheosis of the expert class really came after the turn of the millennium, and especially after 2008, and in 2020 we saw, just as you said, an orgy of the extravaganza of dictatorial control by these people that have very little experience or concern for experience in real world stuff, and yet are massively in charge of all of our systems, and they went absolutely bananas. And starting in March 2020, and their dictates really extended from the federal government out to all the states and the counties and to the cities and all the way down to the most local level, using their networks of coercion and compulsion. And then that was because we live in a global economy with global communication systems and that sort of thing. That extended out to the entire world. And really, the U.S. decision to lock down 3 years ago this week was gigantically impactful for the world economy. And what we saw is that none of their plans worked, nothing they organized for us. And it was really a fundamental upheaval. I mean, let's not forget that 3 years ago, most of us at this time were locked in our homes, couldn't go to church, couldn't go to any kind of community gatherings, couldn't see our families in the retirement villages that we ourselves are paying for. We couldn't organize weddings or attend funerals. Even traveling outside the state borders turned out to be arduous because of the quarantine restrictions. So it was a kind of a hell that none of us ever imagined we would live in, or was even possible, because there was never a vote on any of this. All the usual pandemic plans were scrapped. We faced a kind of dictatorship, a quasi-martial law, as it turns out. But the more we learned about it, the more we realized the military was at the center of the pandemic response. And everything that's happened since then really traces to that fateful decision, and that includes the inflation, the economic crisis, the political crisis, political divisions, the ill health, the loss in living standards and even lifespans. We're still dealing with the fallout, and unfortunately, because of the decisions that have been made really every day ever since, things are getting worse rather than better. And this has led to a massive collapse in public confidence in the expert class. And by the expert class, I really do mean a wide range of experts, you know, in government and in media, in academia, and the corporate world. So they're all kind of united on all these things.
Yeah, and strangely united.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one of the signal events of all of that was the mischief around Fauci and Deborah Birx in the White House in the spring of 2021, when they really didn't know what they were doing and pretended that they knew what they were doing and just created conditions that just thundered through society and economies ever since.
What we know is that Fauci seems to have gone from believing that this was going to be a regular flu with a normal public health response in sometime in the middle of February, maybe as late as the 26th or 27th of February, was still saying we didn't need a vaccine, that we would get through this through conventional measures. And then he flipped by the 28th. He flipped in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And then and about 10 days later, he was testifying before Congress about this and seriously misstated a number of things. They, you know, during the Q&A session, they wanted to know, you know, the typical question, like, how bad is it going to be? And so he started his answer by saying SARS-CoV-1, the last coronavirus, had a 10% fatality rate. And so, you know, just from that very sentence, you know, you've got a bunch of ignoramuses questioning him, and they're thinking, okay, this is SARS-CoV-2, so that's not unreasonable. And then he went on to say the World Health Organization estimates a 3-4% fatality rate. Now, when he's using this word fatality rate, you know, what you hear is the percentage of the population that's going to die. That's what they heard. So yeah. At first they heard 10%, 1 in 10 people is going to die from this thing. So it's like the movie Contagion. Then he dials it back to 3-4% from the World Health Organization. By this time, everybody's just practically in meltdown. And he goes ahead and says, I think it's possible it may not be 3-4%. It might be closer to 1%. Okay. But then he says, keep in mind that the annual flu, the case fatality rate for the annual flu is 0.1%. So we're talking about a fatality rate that's at least 10 times worse than the annual flu. So that's all he needed to say.
Uh-huh.
And everybody flew into panic. Now, that date is March 10th. So, and that's a very significant date because the day before, Trump had tweeted out that a lot of people die from the flu and, you know, we mitigate it through normal measures. Just think about that. So it was clear that his head was more or less screwed on straight at that point. But then on the 11th, he tweeted out that the full power of the federal government would be used to mitigate this virus. So something happened on the 10th, the same day that Fauci testified. Now, I've not written this yet, but I've been obsessed with this topic for 3 years.
Yeah.
And talked to a lot of people who know people in the know and a lot of people in the know, mostly on background, that sort of thing. Apparently, what happened was that Trump had this view that this whole virus thing was being used as yet another scam to get him, just like the Russia hoax and the Ukrainian baloney and, you know, all these things, and that this is going to amount to a third massive assault on him. So he was dismissive of it. But some people from the National Security Council gathered around him in, you know, like in the old TV series Get Smart, in the cone of silence. And told him, you don't understand, Mr. President, this is not just a regular virus. This is very likely a leak from a lab in China and very well could constitute a bioweapon as retaliation for your economic policies against China. So this is the bioweapon we've always feared, and we're going to have to use all power of the federal government to combat it. We need... this is a top national security issue. So immediately it changed from being, what are we going to do for a seasonal virus, you know, to get people well, to being a national security crisis cloaked in tremendous amounts of secrecy and cloak and dagger stuff. And
yeah, now hold on a second. Yeah. How much of it do you think was simply nefarious? That is, carried out by people with bad intentions in bad faith?
That's a really hard question to answer. There's no doubt in my mind that some people believed that this could be true. Whether they were dupes, willing dupes is another matter.
Well, with hindsight, there is so much more that we know about this escapade, including the mischief around the pharmaceutical companies and their trials. Yep. And their and the amount of money that was potential profit for them in the vaccines that they had already obviously prepared and conducted basically fake trials on. Mm-hmm. So we know that that part was full of nefarious behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was already a development of vaccines in January. So what was the prime mover here? It's hard to say which of the various interest groups was the prime mover, but we know for sure that the pharmaceutical companies wanted a piece of this action. The online learning digital tech platforms wanted a piece of it. The media was very much involved in this because it was just nothing better than to, they love a crisis just anytime. You know, they love a hurricane. They love, the climate crisis, whatever. Anything to get people to watching the TV and glued to their sets. But this was sort of the ultimate one. We had never in my lifetime had a successful disease panic. So this was really the first one. They've tried, 2009.
Yeah, SARS and
yeah,
swine flu.
Yeah, that was 2005, right? So avian bird flu, swine flu dated, I guess earlier than that. But yeah. Avian bird flu was 2005, 2006. And then we had H1N1 in 2009. We had, as you say, SARS, MERS from 2000 to 2003, which never really came here. But none of these really sort of stuck in the public mind. This one did, and Fauci played a huge role in it. So they told him it was a... Now, when they... The people who told Trump this, did they know that it was likely not true and were just trying to, get him to sign on to the Great Reset? Or did they believe it themselves? That's a little bit confusing. I know several of the people that were... messengers in this respect, and I have never really gotten a clear fix on their motivations here. There's no question that the rumor of this came from very deep within the deep state, and it had been circulating for really a couple of months prior.
Well, of course, the deep state had been involved in all kinds of other nefarious mischief for 2-3 years before. And so that's the reason that I would personally be very suspicious about their intentions and their bad faith. I mean, they had engineered the whole Russia collusion hoax and the impeachment hoax. As you said a few minutes ago, this just seemed like the next thing.
Yeah. Now, in this case, there was also a motivation of a kind of a cover-up. So Fauci was very concerned from late January, early February, that this had been a lab leak from this Wuhan Institute of Virology, that he himself, that had been a recipient through a third party called EcoHealth Alliance of tremendous amounts of government funding. And that funding is still flowing, by the way. I think last year they got another $6 or $8 million. So he was concerned, and we know this. I mean, this is not speculation. He was concerned that he and his little cabal, including Jeremy Farrar in the UK, were going to be blamed for this lab leak, whether intentional or not. And so they spent a good part of the month of February just trying to figure out ways to avoid accountability for this.
Oh, sure.
So you have two things operating at once. This is why there's such confusion about this lab leak issue. You have two things operating at once. So you had Fauci and Farrar very anxious for everybody to believe it wasn't a lab leak, because they wanted everybody to believe it just sort of emerged out of the wet markets. You know?
Hey, and let's not forget that they had engaged in all this funding against Barack Obama's previous executive order, which was a moratorium against doing that.
Yeah. So, and the reason they like to do gain of function is that it's a kind of a, well, it's something to do. There's that. but beyond that, the idea of gain of function is that you get ahead of variants. So you're in the lab and you're trying to figure out what kinds of pathogens could emerge next. So you play with bats, you play with this, you play with that, and you watch the lab and you watch them mutate. And then once you can create a new virus out of an old virus, then you can map it and come up with a vaccine to mitigate against it. So that's the idea of gain of function. So we're inventing a bunch of the vaccines for pathogens that only exist in the lab. I mean, that's just, these are labs creating fixes for things that are made in labs. That's the way it works. And there's the public health idea here is that when the new pathogen comes along, we'll be ready with the vaccine. So the problem is that, first of all, these labs, not all labs are super secure. So you've got a sort of, the lab leaks are very common. They go way back decades, really. So you've got a problem that you're sitting in a lab with these billion-dollar companies and these huge billion-dollar industries funding these labs, you know, all over the world. You've got a pathogen and you've got a fix for the pathogen. Now all you have to do is deploy it. So, so it's lab leak, accidental or on purpose, in any case, turns out to be extremely lucrative. You can create a crisis and crisis at the same time, right?
And so let's not forget that Fauci held patents on parts of these vaccines.
And his own holdings of patents and his earnings of royalties and other employees at NIH earnings of royalties from the pharmaceuticals is, you know, we don't have all the information we need on that. But so anyway, my point is that you had two. The reason there's been such confusion about the lab leak, and again, this doesn't speak to what extent it happened. It just speaks to the messaging around it. On one hand, you have Fauci and Farrar very anxious to deny it. So they commission a paper on February 1st denying that it was lab leak. This is zoonotic origins and this is a normal virus, that sort of thing. So they put out this paper, proximal origins paper, and then paid off the authors several months later with millions of dollars in grants, you know, as a reward for their saying this. So you have that on one hand. Then on the other hand, you had the sort of national security state division. So this is the public health people were very anxious to deny the lab leak. The national security part of the administrative state very much wants to promote the idea of a lab leak because it's impossible to get the Trump and the White House on board. And that also goes for Boris Johnson in the UK and many other governments. It's not possible to get them on board with crushing civil liberties and civil rights unless they believe it's some sort of Frankenvirus from lab, right? So if it's a lab leak, then they get scared. If it's a normal virus that's always circulated, then they're not scared. So that's why you had two things operating at once. Constant rumors of a lab leak and then aggressive denials as a lab leak from Fauci. So at some point, they got on the same page, and they got on the same page by March 10th. Trump changed his outlook completely within 24 hours. It was all cloaked in secrecy, all hanging around the Oval Office, all these private briefings with, you know, bug detectors and cones of silence and all the rest of it. And so on the 12th, he goes out and makes his first public statement of panic, which, you know, and at the end of a a hostage-style video that he gives, a presentation he gave on national television. At the very end, he says, "We're blocking all travel from Europe, UK, Australia, and New Zealand," and then accidentally says that applies to goods too. That turned out to be a misreading of the teleprompter, which the White House had to correct the next day. But that was on the 12th. So for the first time in the American history, you know, you suddenly the government was entirely in charge of whether or not your friends and family can come visit you or whether you can go visit them. I mean, the blockage from China had already occurred in January. Mm-hmm. And nobody cared that much about it. I mean, it was actually funny because the right wing in those days was praising that decision. The left wing was saying, oh, it's racist and terrible.
Right.
So then they flipped. By March 12th, the look of panic on Trump's face encouraged all the people with Trump derangement syndrome to think, ah, now we've got him in our crosshairs, right? We've got this guy now. So they didn't complain about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And then the very next day, Health and Human Services put out a document that they had been preparing for at least a couple of weeks, making it clear, this is a private document, it wasn't revealed until about 6 or 8 weeks later, that made it clear who was going to be in charge of the pandemic response. It wasn't the CDC. It wasn't NIH. It was the Department of Defense, the National Security Council, and Department of Homeland Security, generally speaking. So that was March the 13th, and that was the day that martial law basically came to America. That was on a Friday. So now the question became, what are the next steps? So they had exactly 2 days, Saturday the 14th and Sunday the 15th, to get Trump to green light full-scale lockdowns of America. Now, how did they convince him? So they've already got him extremely rattled with the idea that this is very possibly, very likely a bioweapon from China. So they said, Mr. Trump, you've got to beat China. Now, let's look at what Xi Jinping did in the face of this virus in Wuhan. What he did was he locked all of his citizens down, prevented people from moving. It was a brutal response, but in a period of just a few weeks, he made the virus go away. Because if you don't have people contacting other people, then they can't spread the virus, and the virus dies out and goes away. So, he is today celebrated as a great man for what he did. Despite the brutality of the response, he saved his Chinese population from this virus. You, Mr. President, are at least as great as Xi Jinping. And I'll tell you something else. There's something else you need to know, Mr. President. We've already mapped this virus. We have a vaccine in production. It's been in production since January because we had very good contacts in China. So we've got a vaccine already available that using this new mRNA technology. This vaccine will become available not in 5 years, not in 10 years like in the old days. Nope, we spent 20 years in developing this new technology, mRNA, so we can produce a vaccine very quickly. So you lock us down, that will stop the transmission. Then we get a vaccine, get everybody in the country vaccinated against it. We don't have a problem. You open the economy up. You, Mr. President, will be the savior of this country, and you will sweep into election with the greatest landslide in American history. So he's sitting there listening to this story and thinks, well, sounds like a plan. Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, it also sounds like a tremendous effort of mindfuckery.
Yeah, it worked, and it only worked because they were able to create this sort of hothouse environment of national security and secrecy. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get this sense of rush of the power. I mean, how does a president can't even legally shut down the country? He can't mm-hmm. do it. I mean, there's no legal mechanism to do this. But at this point, they didn't care about what was legal and what was not. So they managed to. So Trump approved 2 weeks, right? And he went out to a press conference, a weirdly calm and even jocular sort of light press conference. On the March 16th, at which President announced the lockdowns, and he was surrounded by military guys, by public health people, Fauci and Birx especially. And by the way, we know that we only know of something like 5 to 7 people that were around Trump on the weekend of the 14th and 15th, but it was definitely Fauci and Birx and Kushner and Kushner's two friends that he pulled from the digital tech, data industry. And why they were there, I don't know. I mean, I speculate, but just friends of Kushner, And then also on the phone was Scott Gottlieb, who's the chairman of, or not chairman of, but he's on the board of directors of Pfizer, former head of the FDA. So they all persuaded Trump of this. And so Trump gives a press conference, so he says, look, we're just going to have 2 weeks flat in the curve. And somebody from the press raises his hand and says, I'm a little confused. What are you saying here? Are you saying that bars and restaurants should close? I mean, it's obviously, if you're closing bars and restaurants, you're also closing churches, homes, and businesses and everything. I mean, you're destroying everything that we call civilized life. So it's a reasonable question. At that moment, Trump demurred, and Birx looks to Fauci, where Fauci motions to her, and so she steps up to the microphone and starts this gibberish talk about whether it spreads on surfaces and data, and just, kind of pot boiling your bullshit, not really saying anything. Fauci gets frustrated and interrupts her, and she says, oh, Fauci, he's my mentor, he wants to talk, I always defer to him, come on up to the microphone. Now, it's clear when you watch the video, they've been waiting for this moment. This press conference has gone on for a better part of an hour, but they've been waiting for this moment. And Fauci stands up, he says, now, if you take the piece of paper that I handed out to you, if you look on the second side in very small print right at the bottom, it says the following thing, and he reads it. So very clever, right? He's reading text that the White House issued, but he's not taking personal responsibility for it. He's just saying, read what's on your paper. And what it says on the paper is, all indoor and outdoor venues where people congregate should be closed. And he steps away from the microphone and goes back to his spot. And he looks at Birx. She looks at him. They both smile. He gives a nod of his head, and she smiles back at him. That was the moment they were waiting for. Now, what was Trump doing during the reading of this small print? He's looking out over the crowd. Somebody gets his attention, and he waves to them, and he's pointing at them. He's clearly not listening to what Fauci says. He didn't actually hear, because Trump gets bored after 3 minutes anyway. So we're talking about an hour deep into this press conference. Trump's paying no attention whatsoever. Somebody gets his attention in the crowd. He's looking at them, so he's not listening even to. And you can tell that he didn't listen to what Fauci said, because the very next follow-up question is, are you ordering closures of all public gatherings? And Trump says, now we haven't done that yet. We're not doing that yet. We may yet do that, but for now we're not doing that. Okay, so his statement then contradicted what Fauci had just said. So you've got to figure, what actually happened. Now, it's possible that Trump was in on this and knew exactly what was on that paper, and just didn't want to take responsibility for it, so deliberately caught somebody's eye in the audience, pretended not to listen, and then directly contradicted Fauci when he got up to the microphone as a way of kind of avoiding, he's locking down the country, but he's saying he's not locking down the country, right? Mm. So that's one possible interpretation. Another is that they just bamboozled him, and he didn't know it was on the piece of paper, and that somebody in the audience was positioned there to get his attention, so that he wouldn't pay any attention to Fauci. That's possible. too. But so it's hard to know what the underlying truth is.
Hey, I must say that in the TV appearances that followed that one, it was my impression that he was profoundly uncomfortable with what was going on. You could see it in his body language very clearly.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, and part of the reason he was uncomfortable was because the real reason he was doing this was for national security reasons. He thought it was a bioweapon, but he didn't want to panic the country. Mm-hmm. So he was thinking in his head, God, if people knew the truth, they'd be running the streets like their hair was on fire, right? But he didn't want to do that. I don't think at that moment he had yet gotten suspicious that that he had been bamboozled. You know, he had previously been suspicious that this whole virus thing was just another attack on Trump. But at that moment, he was a kind of a believer. You know,
well, I must say the pressures on him, you know, whatever you think of his character, his very complex and peculiar character, you have to admit that the pressures on him to, you know, to swallow this story must have been just enormous.
I think that's really true. It was a huge, huge pressure on him, but that was all deliberate. It was a created pressure, and he felt it. Now, here's what's interesting. It's like you reconstruct the timeline to see when he became suspicious that this is the whole thing was a scam. Now, before the 2 weeks were over, he starts to get really frustrated and says, all right, and also the vaccine is nowhere to be seen, right? I mean, he's doing Operation Warp Speed. He wakes up every morning screaming at everybody, where's my vaccine, where's my vaccine? After 10 days or so, he feels like he's not getting answers, but he's thinking, I can't just preside over the destruction of this country. Like, this is crazy. So he makes an announcement that for sure this country will be entirely open by Easter. Now, that's a very interesting date, because the date of Easter at that point is more than a week beyond the initial 2 weeks to flatten the curve. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So he's already announced to the whole country that the lockdowns are going to continue beyond 2 weeks. Fauci and Birx listened to this and said, aha, that's what we've been waiting for. We knew we had to go back to him and ask for another 30 days or months or whatever. I mean, they had every intention of carrying this all the way to the election. He didn't know that. But when he said we're going to open by Easter, they're like, aha, he's open to an extension. So that day, they went to him and said, Mr. President, we've made great progress with these lockdowns. Good decision, brave decision. You're doing the right thing, handling this thing beautifully. But if you open by Easter, you're really introducing a danger of massive community spread, and all the gains we've seen over the last 10 days or so will be thrown away. We really need. They were going to ask for 2 weeks. But instead, because they took cues from Trump's Easter line, they realized that he was open to already had been convinced of an additional 2 weeks. So they decided to ask for 30 days. He grants them that 30 days. But then very soon after that, he got angry. He got angry that he'd been talked into an additional 30 days. He stopped speaking to Birx. But he's still very rattled, right? So he's got of two minds now. He wants to open the country, but he also thinks it's a bioweapon that could kill, you know, millions of people. He thinks he's already saved millions of people from death, which is nonsense, but that's what he believed. So on one hand, he wants to open up the country. On the other hand, he's really terrified of being blamed for mass death.
Mm-hmm.
And so that situation lived in his brain for the better part of the next 2 or 3 months, continuing throughout the first half of summer. So when Georgia opened, he got really mad and said, "You can't open Georgia without my permission. This is a huge mistake." So, and he sent out a tweet also as late as the end of April saying, "You cannot, you know, just to be clear, some people are under the impression that states are allowed to make their own decisions about when to open. Let's just be clear, that's entirely up to the president of the United States." So he's playing both sides at this point, right? On one hand, sort of calling for opening, and on the other hand, denouncing any governor who opens the state. And what broke him completely or made him convinced that he had been tricked was, of course, the Black Lives Matter protests of the summer, where all the same public health officials that were telling everybody to stay in their home, stay safe, mask up, and to not gather in any kind of super spreader events and all this kind of nonsense, suddenly shifted. And they said, well, racism is a public health threat that's even greater than COVID. So it's okay to go out and protest, and you should. Well, that was a great relief for the country at that point, because now you could break lockdowns for the first time in months while being congratulated and celebrated by the media for opposing racism.
Right.
So that went on for a little while. You know, we had several weeks of that, and, you know, and part of that was, you know, burnings and, you know, riots, and, you know, it wasn't all peaceful, you know. And then public health announced, all right, everybody back to your homes, back to your lockdowns. You know, so I hope you had enjoyed yourself. You know, we made a real great statement against racism, but now it's time to go back to lockdowns. And then now that takes us to August. And Trump is just at this point just fit to be tied and thinking, you know, there have been a lot of people that I've watched on Fox News and some of the economists in my administration, some other people have been telling me for a while that this whole thing is ridiculous, that it's not nearly as deadly as everybody says, that this is maybe a conventional virus, and that I've been tricked. So he got on the phone, called Scott Atlas from Stanford University, Hoover, and invited him to D.C. and said, so Scott Atlas arrives, and they spend an evening together. And Scott explains the truth about this virus that we know from all the data we've had since February, that it's got a huge age gradient, that the only people vulnerable are basically the only people who are going to die from this are at the age of death anyway, and they typically have two or three comorbidities, that there's all sorts of therapeutics that are available. We need to start focusing on getting sick people well and let everybody else go about their lives. And so Trump is like, you know, that's great. You're now my virus guy. So I grant you all power to unravel this disaster and open up the country. And Scott Atlas says, thanks very much. The problem is that while Trump wasn't looking and paid no attention, the administrative state had completely taken control of the country, and Trump had been reduced to no better than a marionette at this point. Mm-hmm. So he was running around saying, open up the country. The case fatality rate is actually not that much higher than the flu. You know, we should be protecting the vulnerable. And by that time, you had, you know, the pharmaceutical company gearing up to release their vaccine. You had the big media making the big bucks hand over fist. You had Congress spending trillions of dollars. Governors getting a windfall. You had Americans getting $2,000-$3,000 dropped into their bank accounts courtesy of the U.S. Treasury. You know, everybody had fallen in love with lockdowns at this point. Mm-hmm. Lockdowns are great. We're getting rich. What could go wrong? So he had no constituency for opening up at that point. And then, of course, you know, we moved into election season, and lo and behold, the election couldn't be a normal election. Now we have to have mail-in ballots from everybody. And then the Zuckerbergs and, you know, everybody got involved in that. And so they're distributing mail-in ballots like from helicopters, you know, flying all over the country to make sure and warning people not to go to the polling stations because they're going to get sick. So just mail in your ballot and you're probably the biggest, most fraudulent election in American history. We still don't know exactly what happened.
Is it your opinion that it was a stolen election?
I think it was rigged. Whether Trump would have won in absence of that, I have no way of knowing. I really don't know. But I do know that it was Trump's decisions about concerning COVID that led to the technical loss.
And I think it looks in hindsight like it was a successful effort to get rid of him.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, it was an incredible achievement for the entire elite class.
Now let's rest at this point and go forward. This podcast is brought to you by the Vaulted Gold Investment Platform, a service of McIlvaney Wealth Management. Gold has been a go-to asset for centuries, and with good reason. It has no counterparty risk. Stocks depend on companies staying in business. Bonds were loans that someone has to pay back. Gold is and always has been pure gold with no strings attached. As inflation keeps rising, and it's over 6% now, many investors are looking for ways to protect their wealth and ensure that it retains its value over time. While many assets have been struggling lately, gold is making a comeback in portfolios as investors seek to hedge against inflation. Vaulted is a platform that makes it easy and convenient for investors to acquire, store, and manage their gold holdings. The gold is stored at the Royal Canadian Mint, ensuring that it is safe and secure. Because they cut out all unnecessary middlemen, they can offer some of the best prices in the market. And you can request physical delivery at any time. There are no hidden fees, making it a transparent and cost-effective solution for those seeking to protect their wealth against inflation. I use the Vaulted program myself to save. The website is clear and user-friendly. Go to Kunstler.com/vaulted and sign up today. And now back to the podcast. Hugh, what's your overall assessment of where things stand in our country now as a result of all that and all the subsequent mischief around it in the early spring of 2023?
Are we on the road to recovery?
No, not necessarily. That's not necessarily my question. Just what's your assessment of where we stand?
I think we've just begun to see the chaos.
Well, tell me about it. Well, and tell me about the various angles of it, because I certainly believe that.
Yeah. Well, you've got a political crisis with a divide that everybody knows about. You know, where you've got the 1% ruling the country and the 99% having lost faith in it. But beyond that, we have a very real banking and financial crisis developing, and we just saw the beginnings of it last week. And of course, the inflation has been grim. We're up to 17, 18 cents loss on the dollar from early 2020 to the present, which is, which is an unbelievable level of inflation. I mean, it's like it certainly compares to 40 years ago, but it could end up being much worse. The inflation is deeply embedded. Mm-hmm. It's springing up in strange places. You never know. You have to keep up with the statistics very carefully and watch all the releases and follow them very carefully to know where it's coming from. They keep saying it's cooling. It's not cooling. It's not moderating. It's just showing up in different ways. And then the Federal Reserve is trying to combat this with higher interest rates, but that led to a massive interest rate mismatch between all the bond holdings of the banks. Now, keep in mind that during COVID, banks got flush with cash. The Congress spent about $10 trillion. The Federal Reserve printed $6.5 trillion of that. That printed money went straight into businesses and individuals, spent, landed in the banks. The banks got flush with cash. They got direct cash infusions of about $5.5 trillion during the pandemic response, which had to be stored somewhere. And it can't be stored in short-term bonds because they were paying virtually nothing at the time. So the only place where you can get a return on these things were in long-term bonds, 10, 20, 30 year at fixed rates, which was fine. It seemed to make sense until the Federal Reserve started its campaign for higher interest rates, and it went from zero to 4.5 in a very short period of time. The highest, fastest rate increases easily on record in the history of the Federal Reserve. I mean, we've never seen anything like it. I mean, this is by a magnitude of like hundreds, right? We've never seen interest rates. Now, keep in mind, short-term interest rates are still negative, right? Mm-hmm. but we had to go from zero to 4.5 in the midst of inflation that was running 7, 8, 9, 10%. So they're still negative, but just those rate increases, they were huge. Well, these rate increases, of course, bled out throughout the whole right side of the yield curve, causing 10, 20, 30-year bonds to massively increase, I mean, for that matter, 30-day bonds. Everything increased. So suddenly, massively devaluing these fixed-rate portfolios of the banks.
And let's explain to readers that when the interest rates go up, the value of the bonds goes down, and then that becomes a balance sheet problem for the banks.
It's a huge balance sheet problem because they're sitting on billions of 10 years paying 2%, while the peddling truck outside is selling 10 years paying 4 and 5%, and suddenly their bonds are massively undervalued. I mean, they're taking haircuts on their portfolios. At the same time, these highly levered companies that enjoyed such a good ride during lockdowns were also facing a much higher cost of servicing their debt, and so started drawing down on the cash balances from the banking system. So you combine all these things in once, and the thing we feared the most, which was a financial banking crisis, that did not happen between 2020 and 2022, suddenly emerged as it inevitably would. And I predicted all this several months ago. I said, this is coming. And sure enough, it happened. Now, the right response to this would have been just to let the banks fail. You got levered up, you're in over your head. Sorry, depositors in your bank have to take a haircut. We're going to pay 70 cents on the dollar. Everybody clean up your balance sheets. Let's go on with our business. Did they do that? No, they didn't do that. It was bad enough that they bailed out Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic. But then yesterday, Janet Yellen made the most astonishing statement in the history of American banking. She promised to bail out every depositor from every bank up to 100% and totally disregard the $250,000 limit on deposit insurance per account. Totally on her own, without legislation, without law, without even an executive order. It was nothing but a press conference. Janet Yellen just ruined American banking, creating moral hazard like we've never seen before. And I say that not as speculation. We know for sure the response of depositor behavior when they expanded in 2009 from 100,000 to 250,000. Guess what happens? People start socking more money away in the same accounts, right? I mean, it's a so you had an initial dip in the number of uninsured deposits in banks, but now it's higher than ever. Of course, that's what happens because people are rational people and they respond to incentives and to structures. So now she just guaranteed everything.
And of course, the money's not there to do that. So it's absurd.
We're talking about a liability that could be $20 trillion or more.
Yeah. And the FDIC has, what, assets of about $2.5 billion, maybe?
Yeah, that means absolutely nothing. So they're going to have to print it all, which is guaranteed. So now you have two policies running at once. On one hand, you've got the Federal Reserve trying to tighten. I think they're meeting today. And we'll hear an announcement before the close of business about the rate increases, probably going to be 25 basis points. Needs to be a lot higher than that. But so you've got a tightening, hawkish stance on the part of the Fed and the ultimate dovish loosening policy on the part of the U.S. Treasury. So they're very much at odds. So we've got both things going on at once, creating all the conditions you need for a long-term inflationary stagnation.
It's absolute, utter incoherence, utter policy incoherence.
It's hard to imagine a worse set of policies. It literally dooms American prosperity for the next at least 5 years. I don't even know how you reverse it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be president. the idea that DeSantis was running, you know, is just crazy because, like, I just don't know what do you do under these conditions. I mean, he's got a public health crisis, an economic crisis, a cultural crisis, an educational crisis.
Geopolitical.
I mean, So all this stuff is hitting us at once. All of it a result of egregious and criminal level mismanagement of the social order that
by that managerial class we started talking about.
Yeah, by those same people. And none of this was voted on by anybody. It doesn't really appear in any legislation. It's just egregious decisions by a permanent unelected bureaucratic class that's wrecking freedom and prosperity in America. And I'm just sorry to say it, but I've got a really bad sense that we might look back at 2020 as the salad days, you know?
Sure. I want to ask you in the time that we have remaining, I want to talk about the Democratic Party and the craziness that it has spawned in the last several years. Matthias Desmet, who published The Psychology of Totalitarianism last year, said that the public would be asked to swallow ever greater absurdities as this came along. And I've been comparing the behavior of the Democratic Party to the behavior of the Jacobins in France in the French Revolution. And the Jacobins, as we recall, was the most extreme left faction in that struggle. And they completely turned French culture upside down. And they also managed to piss off the French people so badly that they ended up killing them all after a year of their depredations. What do you make of the Democratic Party, the insanity that it spawned? I refer to them now as the Party of Chaos. What's your take on where they have taken us?
As far as I can tell, the Democratic Party today is nothing other than a kind of a front for the administrative state. That's all it represents. It's just the public health bureaucracy. And that's why the Democrats have just kicked to the curb the old left concerns over civil liberties and free speech and freedom of movement and civil rights and all these things. They don't care about that stuff anymore. I mean, all the people that used to be part of the party, I'm assuming like, you know, Robert Kennedy or whatever, they just don't, that it just doesn't matter to them. It's their de facto doctrine of the Democratic Party today is totalitarianism.
Now, we really have to ask ourselves, though, how does that class of people, which includes virtually all of academia and a lot of medicine and a lot of the law, how does this class of people get from being in favor of free speech and against censorship and against coercion and against pushing people around to the point that they seem to accept all of these depredations?
They convince themselves that Trump and the Republican Party is Republican Party represent kind of Hitler, and they
but that's exactly what they've turned into.
Right.
I mean, the psychological process is really insidious and weird.
Yeah. So they're fighting. Imagine totalitarianism with real totalitarianism, and they think they're doing a good job at that. So anything is justified to keep the Republicans out of power and to keep the American people from having their voices realized through representative government. They are convinced that half the country is racist and Nazi-like and very dangerous. So there's something about the Charlottesville protests, I think, way back when in 2015 or 16 or whenever it was, or 17, you know, I think it was 2015, that traumatized them.
Yeah, but that was a prank, let's face it.
It was a prank by a bunch of idiots. And look, I mean, there are dark right-wing forces out there. I wrote a whole book about it. I mean, I recognize it. But, you know, it's not exactly a present living presence in America.
Yeah, the amazing thing is that none of that has manifested in our national life in the last 3 years. Not a bit of it. And yet, they're including the so-called insurrection.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's just not a presence in American life at all. And I admit that I was very concerned after those Charlottesville protests. I thought, oh my God, you know, we got a lot of wackos on the loose. But it didn't turn out to be anything other than a tiny number. And the threat that it represents to American freedom and liberty is nothing compared to the permanent state of 3 million bureaucrats living off the taxpayer with unchecked power. They're the real threat.
And since then, of course, we've learned about the massive censorship efforts by the deep state. And that has occurred really only in the last 4 months, and probably since you were worked up about Charlottesville. So how does that integrate into the picture?
Right. So it turns out that, of course, these big tech companies that we thought were giving us access to information and helping us connect with our friends and family and embodying the spirit of free speech and everything were gradually taken over by the FBI and the CIA and used to enact a deep state agenda. So that's clear. And they're trying to destroy any platform that doesn't play along. You know, the only one of the major platforms now that has anything remotely resembling freedom is Twitter. And now Twitter's under investigation. I think they're trying to destroy Twitter, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So this has been a real shock, I mean, to me. Because I was never a Trump guy. Like, I always thought he was a little, sort of a menace, and possibly dangerous. But the anti-Trump people are far more dangerous in exactly the ways that they always warned Trump would be. I mean, So it's amazing. They've become worse than the thing they hate the most. It's amazing. You hate something enough, you become it, I guess.
That is an amazing thing. Let's get to one other thing before we close. Despite the massive four-part piece in the Columbia Journalism Review by Jeff Gerth about the New York Times' massive moral failure in promoting the bullshit of Russiagate and a whole lot of other bullshit, I came away with an inadequate understanding of how that could have happened from an ethical point of view. How did the editors of these newspapers, and I'll include the Washington Post and maybe to some extent the Wall Street Journal, how did the editors of these papers become such lackeys to this what has become a tyrannical administrative state?
There was a turning point at the New York Times that happened after Trump got elected, where there was just a kind of plurality of woke ideologues that all educated in the Ivy League that managed a kind of a coup against the old regime at the New York Times, which sort of more or less sort of believed in trying to embody the spirit of America. I mean, like after the election of Trump in 2016, the editor, a publisher of the New York Times, sent out basically an apology saying we misread the public and we're going to try to do better. So. Mm-hmm. They tried to do better, but that lasted just a couple months. And then there was a woke-based uprising in New York Times, and that guy got the new editor of the op-ed page got fired for running a piece.
Oh, but let's not forget that Dean Baquet was in charge of the New York Times the whole time, both before the election of Trump in 2016 and after. And he presided over all of the fuckery involved in Russiagate and the first impeachment and, all the pranks that they ran.
So they were the New York Times was convinced that that Trump got elected unfairly and it was thanks to Russia's help. And that once they were convinced of that, then it was just a matter of just writing endless articles trying to find the evidence. They never did find the evidence, but they had, 45 reporters assigned to the task.
But there were elements of it that were so transparently idiotic. For example, the campaign to nail General Flynn and sweep him out of the National Security Advisor's office. Okay, all based on the idea that he had had a conversation with the Russian ambassador. Now, do we not understand that foreign countries send their representatives to our country in order to talk to public officials?
Yeah, it was transparently obvious, but by that time, you know, all the reporters had been signed to the task, and they were just, it became a sort of a doctrine. It's a little bit like, you know, Salem witch trials. You know, once you bring the experts in to find out who the witches are, they've definitely got to find witches, you know. they can't show up and go, oh, we're not really seeing any witchcraft around here, and get back on their carriages and go home. They had to find evidence of Russian collusion. So they worked at it for the better part of, what, a year, you know? And I remember reading those stories, and they were long, right? Like 7,000 words, you know, blah, 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 blah. But no smoking guns. There was no real evidence ever. But once you've, it's a little like lockdowns, right? Once you've invested yourself so heavily in one narrative, it's very difficult to just sort of say, oh, that was a huge waste of time, you know? Uh-huh. So the people in the New York Times just, you know, still believe that there was Russian manipulation of the election. They just couldn't find evidence for it. That didn't mean it didn't happen. And I'm convinced that this plays into the whole Russia-Ukraine issue, right? So then mm-hmm. you have this border dispute in the east, and which could have been, you know, should have lasted a couple of days and then handled diplomatically. Instead, these ill-educated and stupid losers in the mainstream media decided, here we go, Russia once again being a bad actor. So let's choose the other guy in the fight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, whatever his name is, Zelensky became this great national hero, patriot, you know, brave fighter for freedom and all this kind of stuff. So it's all just silliness, childlike stupidity of people with no knowledge of history, no understanding of geopolitics, just a very crude sort of binary Trump bad, everything else good, you know.
Also, let's not forget that how much this conflict in Ukraine is more or less covering up all of the financial fuckery that the Biden family was involved in there.
Yeah, which should be big news, but it's not. I mean, you know, we've all been reduced to Substack, you know, to finding out any real information about anything these days. I mean, the New York Times, I used to be a big fan. Not that I ever shared their politics, but I thought they were more or less, you know, had good journalism or something. But now it's just, you know, every single day the paper struggles to publish as many articles as possible about things that are utterly irrelevant. And otherwise, they're living off their wordles and crosswords and recipes. I mean, that's what New York Times has become. It's become nothing other than a distributor of puzzles and recipes, you know.
Well, I would direct readers who want to find out what's going on in this country and to immerse themselves in really intelligent opinion to go to your website, the Brownstone Institute.
Well, thank you. I mean, we're doing our best. I mean, we only have 3 employees and we're not even 2 years old. But we are covering as much as we possibly can and whatever way we can with our resources that we have. But, you know, in this job, we're working with a whole lot of very interesting new journalistic outfits. There are many great Substack writers and other institutes like Rational Ground. And, you know, they are out there. But I'm telling you, my friend, the old world we used to know is completely collapsed and discredited, you know. The old think tanks, the old media outlets, and just everything is just washed up and gone. The world's in such upheaval right now. We don't even know what's next, and it's hard to know where the hope is coming from. I think ultimately the hope comes from people making smart decisions in their own lives. Keep safe, raise your children well, keep them out of the public institutions, and we've got an urgent need to rebuild this country. But at this point, it's we're not even through with the crisis yet. But the rebuilding is going to take decades, I'm sorry to say.
I agree with you, and it's not, we're not going to rebuild the America of 1963 either. It's going to be something quite different. But you know, we're going to march there together for a while anyway, and I'll check in with you again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're welcome back, and I will continue to check in with the Brownstone Institute. And thanks for coming on, Jeffrey Tucker.
Such a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk.
We will ride again.